dead.
No, I'm getting a recording indicator.
You are.
So the only thing I can think of is let's try it with the non-automatic. Testing. Record level 1, 2, 3. This is recorded on July the 16th, the day of the trip to the moon. This is recorded for the archives and permanent records of Purdue University. It is an interview between Professor Eccles of the Department of History and Dean Andre A. Potter, Emeritus of Purdue University. The subject of this and subsequent tapes, this being tape one, will be the life and the work of Dean Potter in applied science and in the educational world of the United States.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to know who the expert is here.
Well, Dean Potter, let us start naturally with the beginning. You were born in Vilna, Russia in 1882. What in your youth got you interested in applied science and in engineering?
My interests since early childhood have been in music. At the age of about 8 and a half, I started my teaching career by having some of the neighborhood children as my pupils in the playing of an ocarina, or sweet potato. The leader of the band in that Lithuanian town of Vilna heard me practice in the park with my pupils, contacted my father, and suggested that it would be well to have me start my preparation for a career in music, as he felt that I had great potentialities. My father always felt that musicians eat at the second table, and accordingly, instead of discussing the thing with me, he brought me a copy of Benjamin Franklin's autobiography and told me that he thought that I would be interested in learning about the career of one of the greatest people of our times and of the United States. When I read Benjamin Franklin's autobiography, I was certain that I was more interested in a creative career such as invention or innovation rather than music. Again, in consulting my father, I found that the best way for me to prepare for a career of creativeness was to enter an engineering college, and that in order to do so, that I would have to be particularly careful and be adequately prepared and competent in such fields as mathematics and physical sciences.
How many languages did you learn as a young man?
Well, I spoke since childhood. I spoke some German, some French, some Russian, and very little English.
You had to learn your English then?
I practically had to learn my English after I came to the United States.
When did you come to the United States?
I came to the United States in July 1897.
When you came, beside Benjamin Franklin, were there any Americans interested in science or men of science that you were interested in meeting or knowing?
Particularly, I was rather disappointed when I came to the United States that Benjamin Franklin was not in residence then, but I became very much interested in the year 1892 when they had the first world fair in Chicago, in Thomas A. Edison. And I had been reading, had read everything I could get a hold of about Edison and Fulton of the steamboat fame and so forth. Later on, in 1917, when President Woodrow Wilson appointed me on the Naval Consulting Board, I had the pleasure of becoming acquainted with Thomas Edison, who was its chairman, with Elmer Sperry of the as its vice president.
Well, sir, you landed in Boston. Where did you land when you came to the New World?
Well, I landed by Kettle's steamer in Quebec. And then I went from Quebec to Boston, where I had some uncles, and settled in Boston. Then I was then pretty near 15 years old.
Were you accompanied by other members of your family?
No, I was not.
You were alone?
I was alone. And I went from Lithuania, from a place called at that time Memel, to Liverpool, and from Liverpool to Quebec. It took me a little more than 5 weeks to get from Lithuania to Boston.
To Boston. did you at once seek application to MIT, or did you have to go to an American school, high school?
I worked some, and I did some secondary work here. Secondary school preparation. I tried the entrance examinations to MIT when I was not quite 16. And apparently did well enough that the secretary of the faculty, who was also the admissions officer, asked me to come to see him. He said that I did well enough so I could be admitted, but they find that I was born in August 1882, and that MIT has a statement in the catalog that a student must be at least 17, older than 17. So he advised me to improve my English and to work, get acquainted with the country, and try the examination again in May 1899, which I did, and was admitted to the Institute in 1899.
When we were preparing for this, you made a very interesting point about the curriculum of MIT at the time, because I asked you whether engineering had become more liberal in the last 20 years, and you had, I thought, a very interesting point about the entrance examination and the courses that you were
actually
asked to take.
The curriculum at MIT in 1899, when I was entered as a freshman, was a great deal more liberal than it is today. The student was expected to be a high school graduate, although it was the admission was based on his record in entrance examinations. He had to pass an entrance examination in two languages, French and German. He was required at MIT to take one language, preferably German.
Was this scientific German or just German?
Just German.
In other words, read German literature
German,
as well as German scientific publications.
Yes. Well, largely German. He also, Eddie, of course, the entrance examinations included English, algebra, geometry, American history, things of that sort, not very different from the entrance examinations now. And at the Institute of Technology in the undergraduate curriculum, as I said before, the student was expected to improve his knowledge of at least one modern language, such as German or French. We had a year of English composition and a year of English literature required. And we had an excellent course in economics by Professor Davis Dewey, who was a brother of Admiral Dewey, the hero of the Spanish-American War. In other words, there was a good deal of general education in the MIT curriculum. Also, the curriculum was much more general than it is today. It wasn't so specialized.
You mean in what way?
Well, a student could graduate in electrical or mechanical or even in physics. There's very little differentiation between those curricula.
How many hours a week were you expected to be in class?
I don't remember. I really don't remember. It was pretty heavy. It was heavy. The curriculum was heavy. But there was a very close relationship between the professor and student. As a concrete illustration, my first course in calculus, I had a professor by the name of John D. Runkle, R-U-N-K-L-E, who had served as president of MIT from 72 to 86, and then went back as professor of mathematics. When he taught me, when I was in his calculus class, he must have been way up in the 80s, because people at that time were so stupid, they didn't realize that an individual becomes useless at 65 or some such thing like that. One time, as we were studying in differential calculus, maxima and minima, I asked him some question. And he said to me, he says, "Young man, did you ever hear of Fourier?" I said, "No." He says, "Fourier was a cross between an anarchist, a nihilist, and a mathematician. Probably one of the greatest mathematicians in Europe." He says the poor fellow spent most of his adult life in prisons because of his radical views. But while in prison, he wrote some of the finest papers in mathematics. He said, in fact, his friends in France compiled his papers in a book called Fourier Series. He says, unfortunately, we don't have at the Institute of Technology a translation in English. He says, "Do you read French well enough?" And I said, "Yes, I can read French. We have a French translation." He says, "Tomorrow morning, I'm going to give you 10 minutes to tell the class a little more about Fourier." He says, "Then in a few weeks, after you've mastered that book, you come to the class and repeat the question I asked you and tell the class how by a study of Fourier series you're able to answer it. And what would your answer be?" A professor, we used to call him Papa Runkle. He had a long white beard. He couldn't see at all from one eye. He'd see from the squint from the other eye. If you asked him a question, he'll always send you to look at, to learn it yourself. He didn't believe in textbooks. He said he was author of a book on calculus, but he didn't require any textbook. He expected us to be familiar with the textbooks, with the books on calculus. And he didn't pay too much attention whether those books were in English or in German or in French, but he expected us to be familiar. The failures in his classes were practically nil. We used to call him Papa or Uncle. He used to call us my boy.
What I'm interested in is your reference to the ability to read and literature in other languages. When you were at MIT, did you write any essays or do any reading or do any publishing in the field of comparative literature?
Well, in connection with the first year's course in composition, I took as the subject of an essay the lyric poets of the English, the German, and the Russian. And I compared the works of Keats and Shelley with Heine and Verne in German, and with Lermontov and Zhukovsky in Russian. Now those lyric poets in those three countries were about the same age and lived about the same time. They had the same experience in dying rather at a very young age. I don't think that Lermontov and Zhukovsky ever heard of Keats and Shelley, and I'm certain Keats and Shelley had never heard of Lermontov and Zhukovsky. He may have heard of Schiller. I don't think he even knew Heine, who was one of the greatest lyric poets. And the professor of composition was a person by the name of Pearson, who wrote a book on English composition. He called my essay to the attention of Professor Arlo Bates, who was head of the Department of English and was known for his book called The Philistine. There is a copy of it in the Purdue Library. I looked it over again recently. Professor Bates called and asked me to come to his office. And he said that Professor Pearson had called his attention to my essay on the lyric poets of three countries. They had shown that essay to Professor Kittredge of Harvard University.
That's George Lyman Kittredge.
George Lyman Kittredge, who was supposed to be at that time a great Shakespearean scholar. And that Professor Kittredge has extended an invitation to him, to Professor Arlo Bates, and to his wife to accompany me to his house a week from next Thursday for dinner. That started an acquaintanceship not only with Professor Kittredge of Harvard, but with a number of leading scholars at Harvard, such as Hugo Münstenberg, who was the first professor of psychology at Harvard, who had just come from Germany, spoke no English, and the fact that I could speak some German helped me in becoming acquainted with him. Leo Wiener, professor of Slavic languages, who was said that he spoke and could write and could teach, I forgot how many, 25 or more languages. In fact, he taught German and Spanish at the Conservatory of Music. He taught French at the then Boston University. And he taught Russian and the other Slavic languages at Harvard University.
One of the most interesting things that we discussed once was your connection with the founding of Northeastern University.
Well, when I came to MIT, when I entered MIT, I lived at that time in West Rock, in Roxbury. It's quite a distance. It was a 5-cent fare on the streetcar. I couldn't afford to use the streetcar very often. It was about 3.5 miles or so, 4 miles from the Institute of Technology, which was then downtown. I used to walk. And I had some free time during the day. I'd have a class and then I'd have some free time. I had no place to study. MIT was very poor and very crowded. Most of the laboratories were in cellars or sub-cellars. And I asked Professor Dewey, the professor of economics, to whom I took a special liking, where I could find a place to study. And he said, the best thing for you to do is to pay $5 and take out membership in the Boston YMCA. He said, it'll give you a chance to have a place to study. If you like to use the gymnasium, they have a pretty good gymnasium. It's a good thing for you to use a gymnasium once in a while. MIT didn't require physical education or anything of that sort. He says also, he said, you'll get acquainted with people of a different type that you meet at the Institute. It'll be a good thing for you. I became acquainted at Eastern University with Speer, who was then secretary of YMCA, a very delightful fellow, well-educated, and not long after I became acquainted with him, he wanted me to teach a night class, 2 hours a night, I think it was for twice a week, and I think they paid me 25 cents an hour, or maybe it was 25 cents an evening, I don't remember now. But it was a substantial compensation for a person who had to support himself and help a mother, a younger brother. So I became acquainted with him. Later on, as I was at the Institute, I taught more and more classes at the Boston YMCA. And I became very much convinced that that there is a need for places such as the YMCA to aid people in their education who cannot afford to go to school full time. Later on, I taught courses in drawing, in mechanism, in elements of electricity, and so forth. After I graduated from MIT, I kept in very close touch with Mr. Speer, the secretary, and encouraged him to increase the offerings of the Boston YMCA, and helped him in making certain contacts with people at MIT and at Harvard and in Boston in general, who could suggest things to him and help him. And that resulted in Eastern University. If you could stop that for a second, I'll get you a book.
This is to record that Professor Potter showed me a history of Northeastern University in the course of our discussing the role that he played in help establishing this university in Boston, Massachusetts.
And was the recipient of one of the first, if not the first, honorary doctor's
degree. Honorary doctor's degree at Northeastern. How very, very interesting. That is important. One thing that rather struck me in our interview was the fact that you seemed to be trained as a mechanical engineer, and yet you got your undergraduate degree in electrical engineering at the time that they did not have a special emphasis at MIT in electrical engineering. Will you tell me about that?
Yeah, that's a matter that is rather interesting. As I said earlier, the curricula at MIT were far from specialized. By reason of the fact that I did not have to take modern languages, that I had enough knowledge of languages, and that I was able to earn credit and some other subjects by examination, I was able to include in during the first 3 years a number of courses outside of electrical engineering, courses which ordinarily would be in mechanical engineering, and also in physics, extra work in physics. The degree which a person received from MIT depended very largely on the thesis he did.
This is an undergraduate thesis, not necessarily an honors thesis.
Everybody had to have an undergraduate thesis. And we had to submit our subject immediately at the beginning of our senior year. So I went to the head of mechanical engineering, Gaetano Lanza. I'll show you his picture in just a little while. And told Gaetano Lanza that at Everett, Massachusetts, there was installed in a factory a new kind of prime mover called the steam turbine. I told him the steam turbine was something that was invented by Hero of Alexandria about 100 years B.C. and that it's coming in its own, and that I would like to carry on a thesis on the steam turbine. I said I became so much interested in it that I heard there was a new book out on steam turbines by A. Stodola, S-T-O-D-O-L-A, of Zurich, who was then professor at the Ingenieurisches Technisches Hochschule. I also told him that I had written a letter to the manager of the Laval Company of Sweden in the United States, telling him of my interest in doing a thesis on the steam turbine and asking him as to whether provisions could be made, where I'd be given employment during some vacations or weekends, so I could come over to Trenton, New Jersey, see how the turbine is manufactured, learn something about its design, talk to some of the engineers and other people who are concerned with its development and construction. Gaetano Lanza, professor of mechanical engineering and head of the department, said to me, he says, "Now, young man, why don't you take something practical?" He says, the Laval turbine was invented by a Swede. The Swedes are great dairy people. And a machine like a turbine is all right for driving cream separators, but it'll never be any good for industrial uses. He says, nobody could use a turbine for pumping water. You couldn't use a turbine in textile mills. He says, as a matter of fact, I thought something about you in connection with a test of a new pumping engine that was installed recently in Chestnut Hill, Massachusetts.
It's out by the reservoir.
By the reservoir, yep. Chestnut Hill Reservoir in Brooklyn. And that he thought that this is good enough for four students to cooperate. And I told Professor Lanza that weighing water and reading a gauge or two, and maybe a thermometer, does not interest me too much. And that either I do a thesis on the steam turbine as I want to do, on the Laval turbine, or I'm going to, I have an idea about the thesis in electrical engineering. And he said to me, he says, "Well, young man, you are making a mistake." He said, "Not to learn more about that latest kind of a pumping engine." So I went over to see Professor Charles Cross. I'll show you his picture also. Professor Cross was not called Professor of Electrical Engineering. He was called Professor of Physics. He was head of the Department of Physics, taught a very heavy load, and was also in charge of electrical engineering. I showed him the letter from the Laval company, told him my experience with Lanza, and stated that recently I had read in the General Electric Review that the General Electric Company has developed a power transformer. So you can take electricity at ordinary voltage, such as 110 or 220, and push it up to a couple thousands, transmit it over small and inexpensive wires, considerable distances, then step it on again to the voltage you want, such as 110 or 120 or 220. Professor Cross says, that would be wonderful. And I said, now the trouble is, where could I get two transformers? I like to get one transformer that is only parts, so that I could learn something about it by assembling it. I like to have one transformer that I can test, if necessary, to destruction. I said, where is the transformer manufactured? He says, it's manufactured in Schenectady. I said, I'd like to have some way of financing a trip or two to Schenectady during weekends or vacations, so I could talk to the people who design and build the transformers and see transformer built. And Professor Cross said, why? Moody, who graduated in the class of 1896 in electrical engineering from MIT, he says, has recently been put in charge of transformers. So I did my thesis on transformers. When I graduated on June 2nd, 1903, this country had an economic imbalance. I don't think we called it depression then. And jobs were very scarce. We had 191 engineering graduates in the class of 1903. And I don't think there were more than two handfuls that had any kind of a job. I was one of the fortunate ones who was employed by Mr. Moody in the General Electric test with the idea that after I had become acquainted with how to handle machinery, that I would be transferred to his organization and he would train me as a transformer engineer. After I had been...
Were you employed in a special department of General Electric?
I was employed in the test department.
In the test department.
And indeed, as I was working, I graduated, I think, June 2nd or 3rd. And the next day I reported for work. I didn't have money enough to take vacation. But that was in June. Early in November, I smelled steam in back of Building 11. And I went to my superior, whose name was Collins, and I said to him, I said, is the General Electric Company building any steam engines? I smell steam in back of 11. He said, why haven't you heard? The General Electric Company has acquired the rights for the manufacture of the Curtiss steam turbine, which is different. I said, well, how does it differ from the Laval turbine? He said, instead of having one wheel, it has a number of wheels. And it's a multiple expansion turbine rather than a single expansion turbine. And I said, would it be possible for me to go in there and have a look at it? He says, yes. He says, there's Mr. W.L.R. Emmett, who is head of the turbine and lighting department. And then Mr. Charles Curtiss, a patent attorney, and there is Dodge, who is charged with experimental turbine department. He says, go ahead, I'll have somebody take care of your water box. I was handling a water box for resistance. Go ahead and see what you're doing. When I came in there, I was dressed in my overalls and black shirt. I told them I'm working in the test, that I became very much interested in the steam turbine by reason of the Everett installation of a little De Laval turbine, that I had read Stodola's book on Dampfturbinen, and that I feel that with the development of electrical machinery, that the steam turbine is going to have an enormous future in connection with power production. And Mr. Emmett says, why? can you read German well enough to read the Stodolostoevsky? And I said, yes. Well, I looked around, we talked a while, and then I said, hey, Mr. Emmett, I say, would I be permitted after work? I said, when I work days, we work from 7 to 5:30, and I usually have some milk and crackers on the works, and I'm free evenings. I said, if you work nights, we work from 7 the evening to 7 the next morning, and I don't have to sleep 12 hours. I have time to work around. I said, would you permit me to spend some time here observing what you are doing and maybe helping you as a result of my study of Stodola's book? And he said, well, that's very generous of you. He said, but it's a matter of company policy. He said, I'll have to talk to Mr. E.W. Rice, who was director of engineering, later on was president of the company. And he says, you'll hear from me later. The next morning, Mr. Collins, the head of the test department, came up to me and he said, there is Charlie Wilson. Mr. E.W. Rice's office boy, who is to bring you over at once to Mr. Rice's office. I said, who is Mr. Rice? He said, Mr. Rice is the top engineer of General Electric Company. By the way, later on, he was president of General Electric. And by the way, Charlie Wilson, the errand boy, also became president of General Electric. See, General Electric isn't very choosy. They'll appoint as president an engineer or even an office boy if he has the abilities. And I said to Mr. Collins, I say, have I time to change my clothes? I don't want to go over to Mr. Rice's office in overalls and a black shirt. He says, no, Charlie's waiting for you here. You go right to Charlie. So when I came over to Mr. Rice's office, I'd never talked to an engineer in my life. And I was scared. I thought I had lost my job. And jobs were scarce. And I found that he lifted up his face, a very interesting face. And he said to me, are you the young man who has been filling your suggestion boxes with ideas? And I said, well, Mr. Rice, I have quite a little bit of time when I'm not working. And I spend that looking around the works, around the plant, and if I see something that I think may be helpful to the General Electric Company, I said, I think it's my duty to communicate. And I said, there's another reason too, very important reason. I say, I have a mother. My father is dead. I've been helping my mother, younger brother. And I said, the wages that I'm receiving here hardly give me enough to take care of things. And I said, it's very helpful to me to find every Friday when they give us our pay envelope. We didn't use checks then. We had a pay envelope on Fridays.
To find cash. You were paid in cash.
In cash. To find a crisp $1. Once in a while, a $5 bill. I say, I even had one or two $10 bills stuck in there. And Mr. Rice says, well, now, recently, you made two suggestions, which are patentable. He says, one is the use of selenium in connection with the electric cars, which are used now in the Boston subway, which will be used in New York subway soon. Boston was one of the first subways in this country. Says the second one is, you have an idea of an electric valve for governing engines and turbines and things of that sort. Says both are patentable, and both are in the realm of Mr. W.L. R. Emmett, who is in charge of the turbine and lighting department. He says, by the way, he says, Mr. Emmett has requested me, he said that he saw you last night, and that you had read Stodola's book on Dampfturbinen. He says, he wants asks me to transfer you from his office, from the test department, to his office. And I said, Mr. Rice, I am touched and pleased for you. I said, I am touched and pleased that Mr. Emmett should think well enough of my interests to want me in his office. I said, but there is a matter of ethical consideration. I said, I did my thesis on transformers when I was a senior at MIT. Mr. Moody, head of the transformer department, helped me with that thesis by supplying me with transformers, paying my expenses to come to Schenectady in order to learn more about transformers, and giving me a job in the test department of the General Electric with the idea that after I had been in the test 6 months or a year, that he may want me in his office to train me as a transformer engineer. As I have no, it was nothing in writing, no contract, but I said I wouldn't feel right to run out of him. So he said, Charlie, to his office boy, tell Mr. Moody to step in here. So Mr. Moody came in and recognized me. And Mr. Rice said to him, he says, Mr. Moody, this young man thinks he has some ethical responsibility to stay in the test until you want him in your office. He says, Mr. Emmett has found that he had read Stodola's book, this is a big thing, and has made two suggestions which are patentable. And he said he seems to be a type that he needs in his organization, and he would like me to transfer him to Mr. Emmett, sorry, to his office. And Moody says, why? Young man, he says, you have no obligation to come to my office. He says, I've been watching you work in the test department. And as a matter of fact, he says, Mr. Rice, I was thinking something after the first of the year of asking that he be transferred to my office. I said, I think he has had, he's about ready to go. So Mr. Rice, EW, said to me, he says, how much pay are you getting? I said, I'm getting 15 cents an hour days and 17 and a half cents an hour nights. The daytime we work 56 hours, nights we work 60 hours. He says, when you go to Mr. Emmett's office, you will be working from 8:30 to 5. And your starting pay will be $25 a week. I started figuring out how much it meant per hour, rather rapidly. I never felt so wealthy in my life before or since. And that's why an individual who was educated as an electrical engineer was trained to be a steam turbine specialist in designing, devoted considerable time on research, working on the specific heat of superheated steam, became very much interested in steam at higher temperatures and high pressures, which was really my main interest during my professional career, and served as president of the American Society of Mechanical Engineers in 1932-33. Have been its honorary member since 1940. And have had a very interesting life in addition to my career at Purdue University and before that at the Kansas State University, which was then called the Kansas State Agricultural College.
How did you leave, or why did you leave General Electric when you were doing so well and go to Kansas. Will you tell me about that?
Yes. The head of the Department of Mechanical Engineering at the then Kansas State Agricultural College had lost his first assistant to the New Mexico A&M College, where he went as head of the department. So E.B. McCormick, of the class of MIT of 1897, wrote to Professor Edward F. Miller, who was his and my major and most beloved professor at MIT, to find him somebody to take the place of Charlie Paul as an assistant professor of mechanical engineering, to finish up the year. That was around Thanksgiving time. When that was, when Mr. Miller spoke to me about it, I told him that I didn't think that I had any interest in teaching. I wanted to be an engineer first, as I hadn't been long enough with General Electric Company really to know whether I am an engineer or not. And he said, I've been watching you as a student. He says, you are more interested in people than you are in things or ideas. And I said, yes, my interest probably in people first and ideas second. And things third and symbols last. I never believed much in symbols. And he said, won't you let me approach Mr. Emmett and borrow you to finish up the year, help out McCormick, so that he can find somebody to take Charlie Paul's place. Well, I tried to argue with him. When I came back to Schenectady and was sitting at my desk working on the report on a station for which I was engineering the erection, that was the Quincy Point Station, near Boston, Massachusetts. Mr. Emmett came to my desk and he said, how are you getting along with that report? I said, I'm getting along pretty well. I think I'll have the report in your hands in around 4 or 5 days. He says, when you finish the report, I want you to go out to Chicago. Getz is in charge of the station, erecting that new station for the Insel interest, for Samuel Insel, with the largest steam turbine in the world, 5,000 kilowatt, and he's having a very difficult time balancing the turbine. The turbines were vertical. You see, there was an electric imbalance. The mechanical is called an electric imbalance. The mechanical engineer said it was a mechanical imbalance. He said, but somehow or other, you know how to seem to be very successful at Quincy with 2,000 kilowatt turbines and balancing those turbines. He says, stop it, go to Chicago. He says, we had a request from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, from Professor Edward Miller, who has been very good to General Electric, to lend you, to help out a tech graduate of the class of 97, teaching school for the rest of this year. He says, we'll pay your expenses to Manhattan, Kansas. And he says, they don't pay teachers much. They probably wouldn't pay you very much. He says, I'll have some little jobs for you that you can do by mail. He says, just as quick as you're through teaching school, you come back to my office and I'll tell you what to do next. Now, W.R. Emmett was a Navy officer, retired Navy officer. In those days, people didn't think we'll ever have another war. And the graduates of Annapolis, when they reached the rank of lieutenant, or sometimes lieutenant commander, they would be retired. And they usually found careers in industry or commerce. Emmett went to the General Electric, did very well, and became one of its top departmental heads. So when I went out to Manhattan, Kansas, I met my first class. I knew what my life work is going to be. And from 1905 to 1913, I really commuted between Manhattan and Schenectady. I'd be in Manhattan the academic year, one academic year, then I'd go in the summer. Then I'd take a leave of absence for a year, 15 months really, and then come back again. In 1913, they made me dean of the engineering school. I had to give it up. But I retained some
during connection. This, during your time, about 1909 or 10, didn't you establish your reputation as a man in agricultural engineering
yes.
by publishing a book?
Tell me
about that.
When I came to Kansas, two things impressed me. First was the quality of the students. The farm boys, practically all, very poorly prepared. We didn't have any high schools in Kansas. Nearly all of them were graduates of a one-room school. We had to teach in the freshman year things that we now teach in high schools. But the end product was excellent. As I compared the careers of my students of the classes of 1906, 7, 8, 9, 10, up to the First World War, with graduates from any institution, even Purdue or even my alma mater, MIT, I am not so certain that hard and fast requirements are so important. Also the quality. When I came to the institute, McCormick, my boss, told people that I had been with the General Electric Company for some time, that I'm an expert on steam turbines, and gave me a pretty nice send-off. And a young man by the name of Emmett Richardson came up to see me, and he says he has to do a senior thesis in mechanical engineering. I was an assistant professor of mechanical engineering. He says, what would you think if I built an automobile? Manhattan, Kansas didn't have any automobiles. Topeka, I think, had one. I think Chicago had a few, not very many. This was January 1905. I said, I thought it would be wonderful. I said, how are you going to afford to do it? Well, he said, my father has an old buggy that he offered to give to me. He says, and a neighbor of ours in a flour mill has a horizontal gasoline engine, one-cylinder engine, that he can't get to work. He has trouble with. I think I can get it to work. I say, I think, where will you get the other parts? Oh, he says, I'll hunt around. I might be able to beg. Maybe I can get some people to present me with some pieces. And he built an automobile. The engine was in back of the rear seat. He made great use of boards and wire. He didn't have enough money to buy bolts and things of that sort, so it did an awful lot of wiring to keep the one-cylinder engine from rattling off the thing. But the automobile ran. And it was really the joy of the people to get rides in that automobile. That was my first time to ride in an automobile. And then towards the end of the year, when he finished that thesis, came up to me and he said, now, he says, people have a steam traction engine. And he was thinking that we probably could do better by developing a traction engine that will be operated by a gasoline, or preferably cheaper fuel, such as kerosene. And he wanted to know whether I thought that I would be able to supervise and help him make a thesis on the design and construction of an petroleum burning traction engine. And I said, I think that'd be wonderful. I said, I don't know a thing about traction engines, but we'll study it up together. We'll work on it. I said, how are you going to finance it? Well, he said he thought he could. His father gave him a little help. And he thought he could build most of the things himself and find things in junkyards and things of that sort. So I went to President Nichols, who was there. He was a physicist who was president of Kansas State Agricultural College. And I told him about Emmett Richardson. And I said to him, I said, this young man is not particularly strong in theoretical subjects. His record as an undergraduate was possible, but he wasn't a top student. As he has considerable ingenuity and inventiveness. I said, what I would like you to do is to permit me to appear before the faculty and ask the faculty to authorize me to have him do a thesis. Take such coursework as he and I feel he could take, but he won't have much time for coursework. And if he constructs a traction engine, oil bearing traction engine, that works, give him his master's degree. Now Nichols was also a former farm boy, became a physicist, worked in the Bureau of Standards during its early days, and then later on became professor of physics at Kansas State, and then its president. He said, I'll give you time. And I sold the faculty that idea, that when it comes to people of special potentialities, that the coursework don't mean anything. So those days we didn't have any accrediting agencies, an American Association of University Professors. You see, really, we live in a very stupid age, you see.
You mean?
And the faculty, I must have been a pretty good salesman at that time, approved it.
I'm interested in this. Do you believe, then, that there has been a sort of decline in our formal educational system, and we've become
I think
too much
been
confined
a decline.
By requirements? And
there has been a decline by having too many requirements of units. I think textbooks are anything but a blessing. I am an author of 3 textbooks, and the income from royalties were helpful to me, but I think it's terrible that the average youngster thinks that a course in history is a book with a blue cover about that thick, about 312 pages, and that's history. When it finished that, he knows everything about history. Mechanism is another kind of a book. And then this idea of examinations. I think it's insulting. It's ridiculous. I think, as I told you, I was something of a rebel. I never believed in closed examinations. I never wanted to be a proctor or a policeman or try to watch people or insult people by telling them not to sit next to each other. I started when I went in Kansas to have open book examinations. I used to tell them that I'll have some questions. They'll come in, they'll have those 3 hours for working it. I don't care with whom they consult and what books they bring in. I'm going to work in my office, and if they have any questions, to come in. And I don't think any boy, I never remember of anybody that I thought was cheating or was taking advantage of me. I gave him questions, he couldn't take advantage of me. He'd have to use his own ideas. And fortunately, I had a man like Nichols, who was president of Kansas State, later on Waters, who was another sensible person.
Now let me ask this, though. You did write a book at this time.
I wrote
on
a book
on farm tractors.
I wrote a book on farm motors. That was one of the earliest textbooks on farm motors. There is that book right here. That's the second impression, second edition. The first edition I worked in, I think, 19. Let me see where was the first edition. The first edition, the 1913. The
Let's see, the title of it is Farm Motors. Steam and Gas Engines, Hydraulic and Electric Motors, Traction Engines, Automobiles, Animal Motors and Windmills.
And this book was the first college textbook in power. You see?
Is that so?
Yes. And here's my chapter on automobiles. Here's my chapter on traction engines. And I have a dandy chapter on water motors and even windmills. Look at my windmill chapter. There's my windmill chapter.
That's
and then I had a chapter on electric.
Yes.
On electric.
Yes.
Generator somewhat.
Yes.
That textbook went through, I think, 7 or 8 editions. And it was for a long time.
That's marvelous. What else did you do at Kansas State? And when you became dean, did you have any particular, sir, did you have any particular theory about reorganization of faculty, curriculum,
sir,
and student body?
I always believed that as a publicly supported institution should serve the people that support it. When I came to Kansas, Kansas was then largely an agricultural state. And I was thrilled with the possibilities of using engineering in the interest of agriculture. That's why I wrote this first textbook in Farm Motors. That's why I encouraged Emmett Richardson, the young man I tell you, to build a traction engine. The way after he built it, he started up a little factory right in his own parents' home. When I visited Kansas State in 1955, a chaperone to my wife, who was celebrating the 50th anniversary of her graduation from that college, here was Emmett Richardson, gray, who told me that he and his son are still building the tractors. He says they don't build very many. He says they build 10, 15 a year and sell it to the neighbors for threshing. And he was known as a builder of the early. He and Hart Parr were two boys graduated from Iowa State College, and Emmett Richardson from Kansas State, who were among the original builders of petroleum-burning tractors. And I was interested, very much interested, in applying engineering knowledge to agriculture. I didn't try to take projects that would help the General Electric Company or the U.S. Steel Corporation. I wanted to take projects there.
Well, now,
I managed the first tractor plying exhibit probably in this country at Hutchinson, Kansas in 1916. And after we get through our conversation, I'll show you a letterhead where I was running that threshing outfit in 1916, a tractor exhibition, threshing with tractors. I became interested in highways. The automobile was coming in about 1909 or 10. I was in Chicago. The engineers were thinking of establishing a society which include all engineers called the American Society of Engineers, in addition to the American Institute for Electrical and Society of Mechanical Software. And I was invited to come in and plan that thing. And I met a young civil engineer by the name of Gerhard with some very progressive ideas about road building to meet the needs of the automobile which was coming in. So I went to the president, the same physicist president, Nichols, and told him I met a young man who I feel could do something to improve the services of Kansas State to the people in the building of roads. His name is Gerhard. I said, I'd like to add him to our staff. He said, what do you think we'll have to pay him? I said, I have no idea, but I think probably we have to pay him maybe $1,500 a year, some such thing like that. And he says, I'm going down to see the governor in a few days. Won't you come along with me? The governor was Hoch, H-O-C-H, a very handsome-looking Kansan. And he had me tell Hoch what the thing is, and the governor said it was a fine idea. So we employed in the mechanical engineering department Gerhard as a specialist in roads, and we prepared instructions for the farmers dragging the roads. You know, people used to work off their poll tax by dragging roads. You remember that? They used to, yeah. Then we got out specifications for gravel roads, how people can build strips of gravel roads, and so forth. And actually the work, people tell me that the work that was started by Gebhardt under my direction resulted in starting the Kansas State Highway Commission, which later on was moved to Topeka. I also became interested in irrigation and drainage, because Kansas was wet on one side
and dry on the other. About halfway through the state,
it started to
get dry.
Yep. Again there, I met a young man by the name of Walker, who had graduated in civil engineering at Iowa State College in Ames. He said, I was very much interested as a young man to getting around and learning what's new with people. You see, the college didn't pay traveling expenses. I just hitched my way around. And I've met a man by the name of Walker with some very progressive ideas on irrigation. Again, I went to Nichols. And we brought Walker in. Then, when I first came to Kansas, I met two interesting men. Both of them were graduates of the University of Nebraska in the class of 1904. One was Davidson, and the other one was Chase. And they had ideas of starting a curriculum in agricultural engineering. Those days, we used to have in the schools of agriculture some courses in farm mechanics, just learning little blacksmithing and little things of that sort. And so we worked together. I prepared my book on farm motors. Davidson and Chase together got out a book on farm machinery. Those were two supplementary textbooks, you see. One from Iowa, one from Kansas. Davidson went from Nebraska to Ames and became a teacher at Ames, and later on the head of the first curriculum in agricultural engineering at Ames. Chase followed him with the second curriculum in the country at Nebraska in agricultural engineering. I followed him with the third curriculum at Kansas State Agricultural College in Manhattan in agricultural engineering. That stimulated my interest in agricultural engineering. And as I showed you yesterday, I wrote the first paper on the design, construction, and operation of farm tractors using internal combustion engines. When I submitted that paper, it took me several years for the American Society of Mechanical Engineers to be convinced that the design, construction, and operation of a oil-burning tractor involves engineering. And I had the first paper on farm tractors published by the American Society of Mechanical Engineers, and I showed you a copy of it.
Yes.
And my interest in farm mechanics, I mean in agricultural engineering rather than farm mechanics, grew very rapidly. When I came to Purdue, one of the first things I wanted to do is to bring about cooperation between agriculture and engineering. And I suggested to the then dean of agriculture, Skinner, that we join, as I did with Jardine at Kansas State. Jardine, by the way, was Secretary of Agriculture later on. And I told him that Jardine and I cooperated in developing a curriculum in agricultural engineering. And I'd like to do the same thing at Purdue. But Skinner said, I heard your interest in tractors. He says, the Indiana farmer will never change horses for tractors. We'll always use horses on farms. And he said, well, what I want the agriculture students is to learn something about operating a gasoline engine, a little bit about blacksmithing, forging, maybe mixing of concrete, but that isn't engineering, and I don't want you to chip me your engineering schools by calling that agricultural engineering.
That's very interesting.
So I didn't get anywhere there until he retired and Reed became dean. I don't think Reed was dean more than a week when he recognized what I've been trying to do. And we started an agricultural
engineering. What you did at Kansas State...
Pardon me?
Did what you accomplish in this at Kansas State have an influence in throughout the country and in other countries in developing agricultural engineering?
I think so. I would say that the person who gave the greatest impetus to agricultural engineering was Davidson of Iowa. I would say I would put Davidson first. I would put Chase second. I would put me third. I think that's the honest appraisal. Although in later years, I mean not later years, but as early as 1908 or 1909, Davidson went into industry and then dropped any contact
yes.
with academic institutions.
But I was just thinking
so
about
it left really Davidson and Potter
yes.
to push agricultural engineering. Of course, when I came to Indiana, the interests were different. Agriculture and industry were pretty well balanced. And I felt the problems that, of course, I was fortunate to have come to an institution which had an unusual group of people that influenced engineering education. W.F.M. Goss.
Now, before we get into your coming to Purdue
yeah.
and the Purdue background, there's one thing that you've omitted.
Yeah.
Will you tell me what you did during World War I, when the United States got into war?
Well, sir, in World War I, before World War I think it was 14 or 15, I mean 1914 or 15, Woodrow Wilson appointed me the Naval Consulting Board, of which Edison was chairman. There I became acquainted with another kid, as they call him, Kettering and I were the two kids of the Naval Consulting Board.
You and Boss Kettering knew each other back in 1914.
So we became, here is a picture of him. Kettering and I became friends. We were associated in many things, particularly Patent Planning Commission. He was chairman and I was executive director. We have been close friends until he passed away. Both of us very much interested in inventiveness and in inventions and in innovations and things of that sort. And then in World War I, I was invited to develop war training in the trades. Those days, we depended entirely on skilled tradesmen coming from continental Europe, Scandinavia, Europe.
The idea that only a German could be a tool designer and a tool maker.
A tool designer and the Swedes. the Swedes would be the best tailors, don't you see? And when the war was started, the First World War, suddenly we needed a large number of people in skilled trades, anywhere from well drillers to blacksmiths to all kinds of mechanics and electricians and everything else. And under the leadership of two Purdue people, Dietz of the Western Electric, of the class of 1902 electrical, and Chan Dooley, also electrical of the class of 1900, who was for many years Westinghouse and later on Standard Oil of New York. There was started a committee on education and training, and I was director in connection with the setting up of training things all over the country. I think I may be able to find, I'll look at it later, the first report of the thing. We trained several million people in the trades and the colleges.
Now, in what
and that
years,
resulted...
In what years did this
that
take
was
place?
1917, 1918.
Now, did this start before we entered the war or afterwards?
It started just after we entered the war.
In other words, this is the grandfather of the ESMWT program of World War II.
This was the one that stimulated the Smith-Hughes Act. As a result of that training, they felt that it wasn't right to utilize the engineering colleges to train in the skills. There ought to be something that should be tied in closely to the elementary and secondary schools. The Smith-Hughes Act was passed, which has been very successful in vocational agriculture, in vocational home economics, but was actually a failure in the connection with the training of people for trades.
Why?
Well, the departments of education of the various states, through politically minded individuals who were superintendents of schools, and superintendents of schools who had no conception what industry is and what skilled trade is. I'm sorry to say, I think that was a failure. Now, the ESMWT is an entirely different thing, and I'll tell you that later. That's after coming to Purdue. But that is training people as aides to engineers and up to the very highest type of postgraduate work. Well, I'll tell you that, and I'll show you the reports on both.
Very good. When